Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. Scorpions Avenue.
Self-help from the hip.
Small dose.
We're talking that shit.
Small dose.
And keeping it real.
Small dose.
With me and MC.
So funky. Welcome to another episode of Small Doses. You know, we are the podcast that just keeps on giving. I really am proud of us. We continue to just level up, and we are doing that again today as we sit down to talk with one of the producers, directors, creators of the Showtime docuseries, Everything's Gonna Be All White, that I am featured in, along with a number of other smart Black folks, and along with a number of other smart, funny BIPOC folks. I think one of the things that I really loved about the series is that I think there's an expectation that if you do a docuseries that is rooted in uprooting the falsehoods of white supremacy, that it's like just specifically going to be about Black people. But then you realize, like, oh, wait, but white supremacy has no boundaries. I mean, y'all didn't even go into the Asian bullshit of it all.
We tried. It is so hard to have three episodes and have everything in three episodes. You know, we had a whole lot of stuff that just didn't make it, but what made it, made it. So
yes. And so we have Jolly Brown Cepeda here. I did not know that you are Sasha's stepdaughter.
Yes, I am.
And Sasha Jenkins is one of the great minds that put this together. And you've seen a lot of Sasha's other work. He was a part of Ego Trip. So if you've seen any of the documentaries on Showtime, like the Rick James documentary. And I mean, I just watched the Showtime documentary on Video Music Box. I was like, wow. But, you know, when you combine all of you guys' minds together, you get this dope ass product, which is Everything's Gonna Be All White. This project that I feel like it's so incredibly timely when we are watching the effort that is being made by white folks to really, instead of curb your enthusiasm, curb your education.
Say it again for those in the back.
So yes. Tell me, Jolly, like, how did you all even like get on the road to doing this particular docuseries?
So it started in 2017. And yes, it started in 2017. So it's been years in the making.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the pre-production part, I guess, or just the, you know, pitching it part really took the longest. So in 2017, Sasha and I, you know, talked about racism as we do, as people of color, Black folks, BIPOC folks. And I read The History of White People by Nell Irving Painter. And I said to him, I was like, oh my God, like, did you know? And it's all about white people, you know, starting from what they were dealing with in Europe prior to colonialism. And then, you know, what race or how race was, you know, started. And it was just very informative. And I learned a lot of stuff through this book. And so, you know, Sasha and I came up with this idea for, it was originally called The C Word. And the C was for Caucasian. And then I wanted the C to be for Caucasity. But there's already a podcast out that was called The C Word, so we couldn't really do that. But I still call it C Word in my head. And, you know, in the beginning stages of the process, in the like initial decks, it was really historical and kind of like chronological. So in a different way than how it is today. And it really centered, you know, the Black experience in the United States. And obviously, you know, as time progressed, I was like, oh, wait, well, you know, we can't talk about racism, xenophobia, and all of these power structures without talking about everyone else, you know, Indigenous people. We can't talk about, for example, episode 2, you can't talk about gentrification without talking about reservations and the whole movement for land back and things like this. And so over time, you know, it kind of became what it is today. But it was interesting because it took a long time for people to say, yes, we went to all of your favorite networks, and they were like, yeah, you know, it's a pass. And obviously 2020 happened. And one of the great things to come out of 2020, we, the collective, know that, you know, we have been the victims of marginalization since 1492. Mm-hmm. However, you know, the rest of the world realized
2020
that this
was like, oh my God,
It was a lot of that.
I had no idea.
It was giving. I had no idea. And we used that, you know, to our benefit. And we came up with this show. And what's so different about it is that truly, on like the writing team, the producer team, the editors, like we're all people of color. I am Black American, Indigenous, and Dominican Puerto Rican. One of the editors is half Korean. You know, we had a writer producer who is Chicano from LA, right? So we had so many different points of view. And I, you know, I was the youngest on the team. I was the only lady in the creative team. Yeah. So it was really dope to be in a setting where, like our white counterparts who, you know, they always bring in their family to help bring their fruitions to life. It was really beautiful that I was able to be brought in through Sasha, and that more importantly, he listened to me as a woman, as a younger, you know, person, as a multi-ethnic person who's coming from different backgrounds, having that conversation about in the Heights and colorism with Black Latinas at the end of, you know, episode 3.
How did that even happen?
That was my idea. That was my idea.
Well, I'm glad you inserted that because I don't even know. I think that was also like an incredibly important way to address media also, because that was a unique pathway in, because I don't feel like there's enough conversation around like the erasure of Afro-Latinos, right?
Yeah.
And so it was like you hit a lot of birds with one stone, because it's like we're talking about erasure, but we're also talking about that with a specific group. But then we're also talking about just pop culture in general and how pop culture continues to perpetuate. I don't understand how In the Heights got made and nobody was like, hey.
Yeah, you know, and like as someone who is from up there, I was really hurt because, as you know, a teenager, I went to go see the Broadway production. And obviously Broadway has more, you know, people who are from the diaspora. And I loved it. I was like, oh, my God, I see myself and my neighborhood on stage. I had never seen that before. And I was really annoying because I was like a theater kid growing up. So I was like, oh, my God, this is for me.
Ditto.
Like, you know.
Ditto.
Yeah, I was. And then, you know, I didn't watch the whole film because I couldn't sit through it. And when it comes to when I think about like Latinidad, I'm very nervous in the way that, or when European immigrants, you know, came at the turn of the century, 20th century, and then had to become white, they couldn't necessarily as whole groups maintain, you know, their backgrounds.
Their culture.
Their cultures as Hungarians, as Romanians.
It's happening within Latinidad.
Exactly.
Because Cubans in Miami are like, please let us be white, please.
Exactly. And what I'm, you know, kind of like frustrated by that, you know, In the Heights, I think, represented was, yes, we have very similar shared histories and we share languages, but even country to country, island to island, our languages change. You know, even country to country, island to island, we have different music. Like, how can you not have bachata and have like dude smoking hookah on a corner and talk about Washington Dykeman. Heights?
It's Dykeman. Like, how you do Dykeman without Dykeman?
I'm like, I have literally been there my whole life, save the past 3 years, and no one just breaks out into flamenco dancing. Like, that doesn't happen. you know, so I was just really, I wanted to have que lo que. Yeah, like there wasn't even like a que lo que in the thing that I, you know, up until I saw it. And so when it goes, you know, like going back to that segment, I just wanted to provide something for my people, you know, and I have many people, but a part of my people who, you know, like we're really not represented. And so providing that space, it was like a 4-hour shoot. And I wish that people could hear that whole conversation because it was just amazing. It was amazing.
You know, I really did appreciate just the level of unique voices. Like, so when I saw Mel D. Cole up there, I was like, how did Mel end up in here? So y'all have to understand, Mel D. Cole is a photographer that I spent much of my 20s and 30s with, because Mel was like always with the Roots. He was always shooting stuff with the Roots. And we just like had the same group of people that we were always around. And I could publish a whole book of just photos that Mel has taken of me from being in the mix. And so Mel was on there talking about his experience on January 6th. And I had no idea that he even went out there for that. But I thought that was such a dope way to speak about January 6th, because I had never heard that perspective. I've seen these white people talking about, you know, their thoughts. I've seen us talking about our point of view from it sitting at home watching it. But
exactly.
For Mel to be the Black man that I know he is and be in that space, it had a lot of gravitas. Like, it really touched me because so much of the white foolery that goes on feels almost theoretical. Like, it can, it's so extreme that it can feel surreal. And so when you're talking to someone who's like, no, I was there.
Yeah. And I mean, I couldn't imagine having been there, you know, like, as you know, episode one starts off with this kind of like a joke that while everybody was doing their January 6th thing, all of us, you know, BIPOC folk, we're home. You know, cooking,
chilling,
just like watching them, like with popcorn.
My mom
like, oh
texted
my God.
Me, like, I think something going on at the Capitol. I was like, I don't know what you're referring to. Turn on the TV. I think something going on at the Capitol. Not even sure of, like, you know what I mean? It's still like, I think something maybe.
Yeah. And like, you know, to center his voice, I just, you know, I was so happy, first of all, that him and Sasha have a rapport. So he was able to feel comfortable to talk about that, because it was a very traumatic experience if you were there, at which I wasn't. But as, you know, a non-MAGA, a non-1-6er, you know, like, it's very traumatic. And I just couldn't imagine being in the middle of all of that caucasity. I'm going back to that word because it's my favorite word. But I just, you know, I think like centering our opinions and experiences of that day is something that other media, you know, hasn't necessarily done well. And even though we were not the majority there, that day spoke a lot and speaks a lot to, you know, just our standings here in this country. And everyone, you know, knows that obviously once that happened, all of us were like, oh, if we did that, or if it was Black Lives Matter or any other organization that centered, you know, the rights and liberties of people of color, it would have had a different outcome. But being able to like talk to someone who not only was there, but photographed it, and, you know, that's something that's it's very heavy. And obviously, as you know, and maybe other people know too, Mel photographs a lot of, you know, social uprisings and instances, happenings. And so to move that center, you know, Black folk. And so like to move the lens to this, I mean, it's just so fascinating. And it's historic, you know, he is history in the making.
Yes.
And his work that day will forever be, I hope, you know, honored, because that was heroic. That was very heroic to go there, you know.
It was heroic for y'all to go where y'all went with this docuseries. So for a lot of, we dove right in, but can you just give people an overview of like, what is Everything's Gonna Be All White? I think on the surface, some people think it's like, well, when you have the idiots on YouTube, they're like, this is attacking white people. And it's like, it's attacking white supremacy. If you consider yourself a white supremacist, then you will feel attacked.
Exactly.
But I would love to hear how you got, that's actually a good thought that I need to say more often. So can you give us a framework for those who have not gotten the joy and honor of seeing this piece of what to expect?
Yeah, so Everything Is Gonna Be All White is basically a tale of what it means to be us in a white supremacist state. Again, you know, the fact that this nation and all colonized nations was founded on colonialism, guns, germs, and steel. And, you know, we have these isms that continue to plague us from that time. And again, it is not that long ago. Like, I always like to say, my grandmother's father was born in 1895, you know? So it's like, that's not that long ago. The 1800s.
Right.
School is obviously not teaching people, you know, timelines and like chronologies and stuff. But basically, you know, it's a show that centers our voices and it centers our opinions. And for those who haven't seen it, we have everyone speaking, from, you know, scholars and authors to rappers to activists to porn stars. And that was very important to me, to include Daisy Ducati and Lotus Lane in episode 3. We have comedians. We have people who are just thinkers, and none of, you know, it's not saying that we all have the answers to these big issues,
right,
but it's saying this is how we're processing it. And this is what has happened to us. This is where we currently are. And this is what we hope for the future. So episode 1 obviously is centering the Capitol, but we're not in the Capitol where we're really talking about race and racism and where that even came from. Because, you know, people even though we know it's a social construct, I think people need to be reminded that this is something that was enacted to maintain power, right? It's all about power dynamics. And I think that everything is going to be all white really is a look at power dynamics. It's a look at ideology. It's not a finger pointing at individuals. It's a finger pointing at ideology. And to stress that, you know, people get so defensive and people don't want to hear that. But it's like you said, if you don't agree with or align with said ideology, then you shouldn't be offended. You know, like my white friends love the show. They think exactly. It's hilarious. Like they're like, girl, I can't, well, they don't say girl, but they're like, Jali, you know, I can't believe that y'all created this. So episode one is about the Capitol. Episode two then kind of goes back and looks at Indigenous America or Indigenous Turtle Island, as I should say, and gentrification and that sort of connection between land back, reservations, project housing, inaccessibility to just basic, you know, rights like healthcare, yeah. Proper food, resources, mm-hmm. right? And then episode three is more about media and pop culture. And episode four is this really cool, it's like a bonus episode. It's a panel of all different folks from different backgrounds. No white people are interviewed in this entire series, which is very important to note. And that was a conscious choice because whether we are looking at history of this country or history of India or history of, you know, what they call like the French Caribbean. So much of our histories are penned by the yeah. supposed victors who are usually white, right? European, non-melanated folks. And so we wanted a opportunity to, you know, let us tell our histories. And hopefully folks will watch this for the years to come. And yeah, we really went hard in trying to talk about so much in such a short amount of time. And I, of course, wish that we had more episodes and more space to unpack the things that we didn't get to. But, you know, we did what we could with what we had.
What are some things you didn't get to that you would have liked to include? That if you were given the opportunity to do a part two, what are some things you would love to include?
I would love to include, obviously, the rise in anti-Asian hate crimes and the way that, honestly, a lot of our people have been like perpetuators of that. Because I think that there's something interesting when it comes to xenophobia in this country. It's a very American thing. And there's a lot of people who, despite what your background is, whether you're Black, white, Latino, Indigenous, there's a lot of xenophobia, you know, that this country just oozes. And I think that what we're seeing with a lot of the spike in hate crimes, I think that there's an opening of that conversation to say why, you know, why have some of our people been the ones who are perpetuating these crimes and have that be an opening to just the American project of xenophobia. I think that's interesting. I also think what's interesting would have been talking about like more Indigenous fights and struggles for land. A lot of people know about the No Dapple protests. I was heavily involved in that with the Dakota.
Tell me about that.
Oh yeah, the Dakota Access Pipeline
it's North Dakota, isn't it?
In North Dakota, yeah. On one of the Sioux reservations, you know, the fact that they weren't just protesting the fact that water is life and water is sacred and they're sovereign nations, but they were also protesting what goes along with, you know, the introduction of non-Indigenous people into Indigenous territories. There's right. a lot of, like when you look at casinos, for example, there's a lot of, you know, rapes and murders and kidnappings of Indigenous women and children that are perpetuated by people who get drunk and go to the casinos. Lots of reservations are dry because of, you know, instances of alcoholism in those communities. And then if something happens to these women and girls, they can't be tried in the U.S., you know, court system or judicial system because they are sovereign nations. And it has to go through tribal councils and tribal court systems. And so there's, you know, I want to talk about that. And how you see in Hawaii, in Mauna Kea, you know, people, so many elders for months now being arrested, protesting the construction of a giant telescope on what these Indigenous people believe to be the birthplace of their people, you know, this mountain being where people came from, similar to the Black Hills, which we commonly know as Mount Rushmore. You know, the sort of desecration of sacred spaces for Indigenous people, I think would have been an interesting conversation. I would have loved to spend more time talking about land grabs when it comes to the U.S., not only about Puerto Rico, but about Dominican Republic and how they tried to annex DR, about Guam, about the Virgin Islands, you know, like why is it that we are still, or just opening up that conversation of, you know, the current day colonial territories of the United States.
Neo-colonialist imperialism.
You know, so I want, I mean, I had a lot I wanted to talk about. I just, you know, I'm like a forever student of the world and of just life. And every time I see something or hear something that sparks my interest, I'm like, that should have been in Everything's Gonna Be All White. And that should have been in Everything's Gonna Be All White, you know, so...
I mean, this is the type of information that is really just actively being fought, right? Like there's so much energy and just resources being spent right now to really try and snuff this out from people's consciousness. And it's not even common consciousness, right?
Yeah.
Like a lot of the things that you're saying are considered to be, I feel like, niche information. Like a lot of like regular folks don't know anything about the Black Hills. They don't know anything about, you know, North Dakota and the pipe. Like they may have heard something in the back, like, oh, yeah, the pipeline or something. But, you know, I think I would have loved to, if there was a part two, I would have loved to see you guys talk about environmental racism that goes on in the way that like Black and Brown communities are so often juxtaposed next to places that are providing less quality air, you know, less quality water. When you look at Flint, when you look at places like Marathon, Detroit, when you look at, I remember I was in Portsmouth, Virginia, and they had a government housing and playground next to a coal plant. And so there was coal soot on the sand of the children's playground. And these kids had like crazy levels of asthma, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, Erin Brockovich, like that movie is not just like a movie. Like, the, you know, these are real things. So
the Bronx, you know, certain sections of the Bronx that have terrible air pollution. Oh, my God. You know, so part two.
part two. No, I feel like, you know, the truth about what we're talking about, though, is the fact that these stories number. Right. Like, there's a whole other docuseries that could be done just on the way that Black communities were drowned.
Yes.
You know, the way that Black communities, gentrification is like a light term for the way that Black communities were literally just renamed, drowned, you know, burned down, et cetera, et cetera. And when you look at just the proclivity of this type of behavior within this setting, you realize like this is not an exercise in generation. Like this isn't just like a facial thing. Yep. Like we are still in the midst. I think we forget because there's McDonald's and there's like access. Like we forget just the level of heinousness that is happening on a regular basis. We can look at like South Africa in the 80s and be like, man, apartheid was terrible. And because we don't have like maybe something like as clear cut as like holding cards, it seems like that's not what's happening here. But in very, very, very many ways, it is. And so this documentary really illuminates that. And it does so in an irreverent way. And that's the special part of it for me. Like, you know, with Smart, Funny, and Black, like that's the goal. Like, how do we get this information out there, but do so in a way that's not necessarily heavy handed, even though it's heavy. Right?
Exactly. And that's why we have these like random little like pauses in the show with like Mad Chad and Rhonda. And like they're meant to be caricatures, like they're meant to be overbearing, and they're meant to be the voices of folks who are watching the show and who may say, oh, well, you know, reverse racism and everything else that goes with that foolery. And like it just, we didn't want to create just another thing that had like somber music talking about racism, talking about the issues. Like, no, you know, it's there are moments where you laugh and you're not even sure if you're supposed to laugh. And like, that's what I love, you know? And then we have that like White Rabbit commercial in episode one, you know? So we really tried to do it different. And, you know, thankfully we had some leeway I wish we could have done more like actual commercials, like parody commercials. Yes. That was my goal. But, you know, time goes by so fast.
It's literally hurry up. Production. It's like, wait, what is it? What do they say? Like, hurry up and wait. It's the opposite. Like, they make y'all wait. And it's like, okay, do it now. We only have 5 minutes to get it done.
Exactly.
I know you've been doing this in 2017, but now you only got 2 months to get it done. Do it.
You know, and I'm just like, okay, well, we are here and we're going to try and we're going to show up. But, you know, I think like, yeah, my opinion about like all this stuff, like when you talk about racism, it's absurd, you know, like it's such an absurd creation, right? Like, and to be absurd doesn't mean to take away the gravity of racism and its effects. But if you look at the thing of racism and how it was, you know, created in a school in Germany, the Göttingen University, that's what I wanted to do. We wanted to go there and actually look at the skull collections of the men who created race. Literally, two guys.
The eugenics of it all.
The eugenics of it all. Obviously, COVID, you know, didn't make that happen. But
It was COVID that prevented that.
COVID, yeah. And then also just, again, timing, having people, you know, like outreach. I'm not fluent in German. I don't even know a word in German.
How do you say black in German? I think it's Svart, something like that. Oh, that's black in Swedish. Never mind.
Yeah, no, like, it's so absurd, you know? So I hope that when people watch this thing, they understand or see, or some people, those who are supposed to get it, they see the absurdity.
Do you have bison on your pants?
I do have bison on my pants. I do. My little brother picked these out for me for a Christmas gift when he was like 5, and I love them.
They're awesome. They're perfectly in line with this conversation because they talk about how one of the ways that white people were able to get the indigenous people's lands was to starve them by eradicating their primary food supply, which was bison.
Exactly. It's all in line.
So tell me this, what were some of the pushbacks that you guys received in this process? I know at the end of the day, we're still creating in a white capitalist construct. Mm-hmm. So even when we're given the opportunity to do stuff like this, it's still under a watchful eye.
Yeah, of course. I mean, some of the pushbacks was that each episode was a bit, you know, it went from this topic to that topic. It was a little erratic. And what, you know, Sasha and I would always say is, no, like, we're always thinking about these things.
It's stream of consciousness.
It's stream of consciousness. And that's why there's so many different elements. And yeah, we weren't able to stay in certain elements for, you know, a whole episode. But that doesn't mean that we're not thinking about these things. And so we wanted to create, in a way, something that showed that, like, oh, okay, we're talking about the Capitol, but then we're going to think about this, and then we're going to go here,
well,
and our brain's going to go
these
there.
Things.
Yeah, so that was always funny. Like, oh, like, this is a lot. And it's like, yeah, well,
for
our
you.
Existences are a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Or it's not even that, you know, like, being, like, for me, being Black, being Caribbean, being Latina, being Indigenous, these are all beautiful.
Multi-layered.
It's multi-layered and it's beautiful. It's not exhausting. You know, I see these quotes on Instagram, like, oh, like, being Black is exhausting. I'm like, absolutely not. It's everyone else's treatment of and, you know, and handlings of us that is, you know, exhausting. But I think it's beautiful and it's badass. And it's just a, you know, testament to the strength and willpower, obviously, of the ancestors, both biological and just, you know, spiritual. But, you know, like, to feel like, thank God we were able to go so many places, but, you know, to hear at certain stages, oh, it's a little bit much. Like, yeah, well, living here is a little bit much, you know. But thankfully, we were really able to kind of like run with it and do what we wanted. And we were very adamant on, you know, like, no, these are important. Every element here is important. You know, for example, the In the Heights conversation, you understood the importance of having all of these Afro-Latinas talking about this in a Dominican hair salon founded by a Black Dominican woman in Washington Heights, who has a whole organization that's for, you know, Black girls in DR, Haitian girls in DR, talking about centering hair and, you know, using that as a way to access power.
You can't explain that.
Like, you can't explain that, you know? And I was like, this is multi-generational. We have, you know, actual people who are from here. And, you know, it was like, well, people have had this conversation already. I'm like, no, people have had one-off conversations, but there's nothing like this, you know? So that was an interesting one.
And also, oh my God, like this stuff just be so dumb to me. Like, people have had this conversation already. That doesn't surprise me that that's something that would get said, because it definitely feels like when you're dealing with folks in these positions that don't have true allyship, they're still looking at you through the lens of other and through commodity. So to say, like, we've already had this conversation, it's like, when did you hear this conversation?
Yeah.
And what makes you think that there isn't more to be said?
Exactly.
And what makes you think that there isn't nuance in the fact that it's now housed in this situation, right? Like, there have been conversations about hair, and there's going to continue to be conversations about hair, because people are still sending their kids to school and their kids are still coming home with their hair being cut by a teacher.
Yes. Yes, exactly. You know, and again, like the nuances of so much, or so many rather, of these conversations that we were having are nuances that, like, we understand. And, you know, thankfully we did have allies on the team who, you know, just said, okay, we trust you. And like, we understand that we're not going to get it, but, you know, obviously push back from others. And it was just, you know, like the porn conversation to me is like one of the most important conversations that I wish we had more time to explore, because it just really speaks to the primal, you know, nature of folks in this country, of white folks in this country.
Can you just set up for people who haven't seen the doc just what that conversation kind of was centered around? Because I learned something new watching that.
Oh, yes, yes. So we interviewed Daisy Ducati and Lotus Lane, two adult industry entertainers who are making spaces for Black women and women of color in their own respective ways. One has a podcast, one, you know, is able to create her own content. And basically they were talking about the terminologies
Mandingo,
that are used, mandingos,
cuckolding.
And cuckolding, and, like, you know, the genre of like white men or like a white couple.
This is what I didn't know about.
Oh, girl, I was like, oh my God. You know, like the genre of like white men watching their white girlfriend be dicked down by a mandingo, which is big, you know, virile man, Black man, you know, straight out of the jungle, which is, you know, that's what is being alluded to. It's very King
yes.
Kong, you know?
Yes.
It's very that. It's very the sexual acquisition of the white damsel in distress. And when you think about the history of this country and the present of this country and the Klan, one of the, you know, people, the institutions that have been protected so long have been white women in this country, even though they enact violence all the time. Historically, you know, and even though we are in a better place of allyship, it is still happening. And so they were talking about being Black women in this field, having to be in certain scenes like this, or be in scenes where, you know, there's racist language being used. And I think, again, like when it comes to sex and sexuality, it's such a primal thing. And so to want to, you know, see a white woman gang banged by Black men, you know, it's like it's a psychological, I think, sort of like diagnosis on this country. And like, what does that say about us? Like the same people. And this is the part I love that one of the girls said. They were like, the same people who have on like the MAGA hats are also the same people watching, like, you know, Black women, you know, in
ebony.
These scenes, the ebony. And then that, right? Like language and how Black women, even in adult entertainment, there isn't an equal
pay
playing
equity.
Field.
Like
there
that.
Isn't even pay equity there. Like a white woman in a lesbian scene, in a biracial lesbian scene, or an interracial, excuse me, lesbian scene, will be paid more oftentimes than the Black woman or
insanity.
Or the non-white woman in this interracial scene. So like, really? Like even in porn? Like that's wild. And when I found that out, I was like, oh, that has to be in the show. Like we need to hit them where it hurts. I still can't believe that this show exists and that we were able to do this.
Well, what has the response been like to you? I mean, Sasha had hit me and was like, I just want to know if you, how you doing? You know, I know you've been getting a lot of DMs, et cetera, et cetera. I was like, I mean, I expect nothing less, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm used to having people say like the worst things, because obviously as like Black women, women of color, we don't even just receive online, oh, I don't like so-and-so. It's always violent. Yes. It's always like, I want you to die.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I've had people tell me that they want me to be killed by cops. I've had people tell me that they hope I'm raped. I've had people tell me, you know, all the things that
I've heard all these hit tunes. Yeah.
I've heard all, these are all the tunes, the top 100. And you know, like, honestly, I have to say, you know, in the beginning, I was very nervous, not because of the work. I was very proud of this work and its art. So people are going to like it. People aren't going to like it. Right. But now we're in a time where people can't just disagree. It's usually accompanied by violence. And that was something that I was, you know, nervous about. And, you know, it's unfortunate, like even with these, you know, folks who have unfortunately been, you know, brainwashed by the system, who are, you
the
know,
Black the MAGA folks. I'm seeing MAGA Blacks.
So, like, so many.
It was fascinating to see how many Black folks who aren't even necessarily MAGA, right? Like, they don't even consider themselves right wing, but they're watching this or even just hearing about it and saying, well, this is racist. And I'm like, how do you not know what racism is? There's nothing racist about identifying facts that are rooted in racism.
Exactly. And, you know, not everyone who, like you can have a racist idea in your brain and you are not necessarily a person who is going to be a malicious racist acting on that racism. You know, I've met people who, some of them didn't want to hear me, you know, call them out. But if I call them out about something, they're like, oh, wait, I didn't even know that that was racist. Like, colorblind ideology to me is racist. You know, like, I understand the premise of wanting to treat people equally. I do not understand the premise of seeing a person and saying, well, I don't see your experiences. I'm just going to treat you like you had everything handed to you. Because, like, that just, it doesn't make sense. But I feel really sad for the people who can't or who see everything's going to be all white, or see any other, you know, show, book, article, podcast that talks about these things that feels like, you know, oh, well, this is wrong. Like, it's just such a disservice. You know, I think that, like, the miseducation in this country has been such a disservice to the same people who are trying to uphold this miseducation of this country. You know, one of the things I wanted to put in the show that we didn't have time was, you know, looking at, you know, pre-Civil War, Civil War, and then Reconstruction, you know, how there were lots of white indentured servants who banded along with, you know, enslaved Black folk, free Black folk, runaway Black folk who were coming together. And then what happens? The white government, the 1%, incentivizes them with finances, with land, etc., and says, oh, even though y'all are, you know, just the same class-wise, you're better because of your skin color. And we're going to give you money to, like, now become bounty hunters, etc. And so I just, like, it's really concerning to me that, like, you know, the descendants of maybe these people who were fighting alongside us and fighting for this, you know, collective liberation, are out here, like, being crazy. And, like, you know,
being crazy.
Just being crazy. You know, some, like, you can use all, my mom, she likes to call them, like, $1,000 words, like, you know, the college words. You could use all of that. But when you go down to it, it is crazy. It's madness. It's chaotic.
Yeah.
It's insanity and it's absurdity. And so, again, we weren't able to really be rooted so much in, like, the history as much as I would have liked to, because I love history. But I think that, you know, if people just take a look back, just one century, 150 years ago, you'll see how what is happening today, like, you know, it doesn't make sense. And it's just all lies and it's all fallacy. And for, like, Black conservative Twitter and YouTube and Instagram that's been, like, coming at the show, like, I feel for them.
Yes, I feel for them.
Like, I'm not even mad. I'm just like, wow.
Like, it's pitiful.
Yeah.
I feel pity. I feel pity. I feel like, I don't know why, but you were in my spirit today, because for some reason I woke up with Eddie Palmieri, Puerto Rico, like, in my head. Like, for some, I literally woke up with, like, Isla Linda. I was like, why is this in my head all of a sudden?
Maravillada. It'd be like that.
The Script.
We have a segment on the show called The Script where we give our folks some supplementary materials that go along with the conversation. And you were just saying how much you love history and you just wish like if people knew a little more, you know, then they could really understand more. And though with this podcast, like we're talking to a friendly audience, we're preaching to the choir, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think what really happens, though, is we arm folks with language that they can then disseminate into their own communities and that they can feel more confident about challenging. I think
yes.
a lot of folks in 2020 did awaken, per se, but the folks that already knew also then felt more compelled to say, okay, now I need to be more vocal about when I see shit. And so, you know, when we have shows like Everything is Gonna Be All White, when we have conversations like this, and then when you provide them with your suggestions for the script, it helps to give people more confidence in challenging. So any suggestions, any books, any docs, any et cetera?
Yes, I am a book person. I love me some books. So obviously The New Jim Crow. I think that that's mm-hmm. just like everyone should just have that book by Michelle Alexander. Medical Apartheid, which we kind of speak to. I wish we had more time to speak about it in episode 2 by Harriet Washington. Talks about the experimentation on, you know, Black women, on women of color, and also on poor Irish women in the North. As the foundation of kind of like modern day gynecology, very important for sterilizations of Puerto Rican women, of indigenous women on reservations, all still happening, all very important. Stamped from the Beginning, obviously, by Ibram X. Kendi, who was in the show. Yeah. I was very happy
to see that too. I was like, oh, y'all got Ibram? All right.
I was like, okay, here we are.
Official tissue.
Official cast by Isabel Wilkerson, because that book, and I'm sure you understand, like you've been dealing with this too. Like I get so frustrated that everything that talks about like inequity in this country, it's about racism. And it's like, no, racism is not the only thing. Racism is a tool. And there's casteism and there's classism and there, you know, there is
sexism.
There is sexism. There is misogynyism, you know, like mm-hmm. it's all the isms and all the knees.
Yeah.
And I think that book really, you know, does well in talking about that. This Bridge Called My Back, Writings by Radical Women of Color by Gloria Anzaldúa. She's an incredible Latina, Chicana feminist whose work has totally inspired like multiple generations of Latinas, including myself. And she's an indigenous woman. There's, of course, like I have a whole web. So I have a website.
I was going to say, this is going to get too long. I was like, I feel like you have a whole database.
I do. I'm literally like sifting through my website right now. I have a library section and an anti-racist resources center.
Where can people see this?
So it is on nuevayorquinos.com. Nueva Yorkinos is my archival project that I started in 2019 that documents and preserves New York City's Latino culture through family photos and stories. Because we are a dying breed. This city is gentrifying like many cities, and I wanted to do something about it. So archiving is a passion of mine that I have been working on. And so on nuevayorquinos.com/anti-racist resources, you could find all links to articles, books, podcasts, what to watch, what to listen to, organizations to follow and to donate to, mental health resources for teachers who are trying to be, on the right side of history, and then resources for kids and for teenagers themselves. So please go to the website and buy your family some books for their birthdays and Mother's Days and all that good stuff.
The Last Dose.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you, like, you know, sharing so much, not just information about the show, but just information in general. This is like my joy, these, you know, having these educational podcasts that still have humor in them and that really just continue to just empower people to know that, like, knowledge really is, in my opinion, knowledge is the ground floor of empowerment. You know,
absolutely.
It really, you can't fight if you're not really sure what you're even fighting for.
Exactly. And I'll just say super quickly before we close, but like, I know a lot of things, but not because I know them. I was raised in a network of people in an intergenerational household and households that taught me the importance of knowing this, you know, like my grandmother, she was a law librarian for 30 years. My Afro-Indigenous grandmother, who had a huge, and I want to get one for my home, a huge map of Turtle Island of the United States.
Nice.
But with no states designated, just like Indigenous nations and like where they are and where they were. You know, my parents, you know, I have two dads and a mom, and I have all the aunts and all the uncles, and everybody was just adding to the
seeds,
pot, you know.
Yeah.
It was all like little seasonings here and there. So that's why it's so important to teach within your own communities and within your own families, because you'll never know, your child or your niece, nephew, whatever, your aunt, your uncle may be exposed to something new that you may know that they may not know. So I am a product of my community, and I just hope to continue to make the community proud for as long as I can.
Well, you are doing a great job. For those of you who do not have Showtime, get the trial. Okay.
Get the trial.
Check out Everything's Gonna Be All White. It's an incredible documentary. Thank you all for having me on Everything's Gonna Be All White, because I really, this is what the whole point of getting my degree was. Like, this is where my real passion lies, is like being able to contribute to these spaces. And it was an honor to be amongst those that were involved. So thank y'all for the work you're doing, and keep on going.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you to Jolly for giving us her time and sharing that with us. Someone who has been giving us their time and their expertise and their skills and their heart and their mind and just their, you know, just their whole dopeness has been our engineer here, Brendan, who, when you all hear the sound effects on this show, when you hear the music, when you hear the unique things that make Small Doses sonically even more enticing, you're hearing the creative expression of Brendan. And today marks not only Brendan's birthday, so happy birthday, Brendan, but it is also his last recording with us here at Small Doses. And I told him he was going to have to come on camera, so I don't know what he's waiting for.
I was waiting for the introduction.
But
thank you. Thank you for the lovely words. I appreciate that. I'm humbled by them.
Brendan, you know you are one of my favorite right whites. And... Oh. you know, I really just, this was my first venture into the podcast world, and you and Rebecca have made that so enjoyable. Rebecca's not going nowhere though. Rebecca's still with us. But you've really like helped to shape this podcast as more than just like me talking, but as a sound and as like a unique space. And then you took that also to my book, to Small Doses, for the Audible that we did. And so I just really appreciate the earnestness and the commitment that you've made to keeping this show at a certain high level of quality. And I know that whatever you are going on to next, they should be so lucky to work with you. This is not the last time that we will work together, because when I connect with folks, we're connected for life. So just know
all
that.
Right. Yes. Thank you so, so much. And you know, honestly, thank you for the opportunity. It is rare to find yourself in a position, particularly in a technical field, to have the freedom to stretch yourself creatively. And I thank you genuinely from the bottom of my heart for that.
Ah, Brendan, we love you so much. So, you know, fly, spread your wings and fly. And I can't wait to see where creativity stretches to next.
Thank you so much.
Namaste.
Namaste.
Star Bands Audio, a podcast network.